This is Anthony Pember, who is a senior manager taking care of the public sector with Deloitte. And he's going to talk, he works in decision analytics, but he's going to talk to us about management innovations and costing advances. Now, you're listening to an Irish accent at the moment. The next accent is from an Australian who thinks he's American. I hope you can make fun of that.
So thank you for having me. My name is Anthony Pember. As was mentioned, I work for Grant Thornton in the US, but I don't sound like I'm from America. I'm actually from Australia. Went to the US for 6 months, 15 years ago, and I'm still there. So as I was preparing for this presentation, I spoke to my... I have two daughters, one 17, who is in that phase where she doesn't talk to her parents at the moment, and the other one who's 19, who has passed through that phase and was talking to me. And I spoke to her before I was preparing this, and she said to me, "Dad, I don't understand what you do." And I said, "Well, I do costing stuff. I work, help companies and organizations understand costs and performance and help management." And she said, "No, that's not helping." So I said, let's do this. What I'll do is I will put this presentation together, I'll send it to you, and then let you tell me whether or not it makes sense. So I spoke to her last night, and she said two things. She said, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "My two pieces of advice. First of all, don't wing it." So I have some notes here, proof that I'm not winging it. And then she said, "If you've got notes, bring your glasses so you can read them," which is a very valuable piece of advice. And then I said to her, "So did you look at the presentation?" And she said, yes, she did. And she sounded quite excited. I said, "So does that mean you understand what I do?" And she said, "No." So I've given up on her understanding what I do, but hopefully at the end of this you have a little bit of an idea. I'm going to meander through some topics. There's the clicker. Actually, you know what? I'll just use the mouse. It's easier. So I'm going to talk about Grant Thornton, who I work for, and then I'm going to talk about an organization called CAMI, Consortium for Advanced Management International. I'm a board member of that organization. It's actually the reason I'm over in the UK at the moment. And then I'm going to talk about a couple of concepts and innovations that I've been working with, that CAMI has been investigating and working with. And then I'll open up for questions. There is a thread behind a couple of most of these topics, which will become apparent as I start talking through them. So Grant Thornton. Grant Thornton is a worldwide set of organizations. I work for the US member firm. We are audit, tax and advisory firm, so I work on the advisory side. I don't do the auditing or the tax work. And as I said, I spent my career doing cost management, management accounting work. So I have much like you, Julia, I'm very much a cost person, and that's my main love. I have discovered, though, that there's way more than cost that's important, and I was very heartened to see value, because there's a lot of my slides that talk about value as well. So we'll talk through that in a few minutes. So as I said, I'm associated with this organization called CAMI. So CAMI is a Consortium for Advanced Management International. Before I go any further, there's a gentleman just sitting here, Ashok. Do you want to stand up? He is the president of CAMI, and he and I have been out here working with our UK chapter. We've just started, some member firms have come and started working with CAMI here in the UK. CAMI is a member-based organisation, and what we essentially do, we call ourselves a research consortium, but what we really do is member firms collaborate, and the key is collaboration. We get together and we essentially try and solve problems that our member organisations have, and we solve it by taking research that already exists, pulling that together and creating executable, usable, tangible solutions for the member organisations. So we like to get together on a regular basis. We have quarterly meetings in the United States, and we're starting to do that over here in the UK. And what we do is produce, and you can see those on the right-hand side, a number of different types of output. And it's along the lines of things like management accounting guidelines, or papers, books, methodologies, models, tools, different types of training, and in some cases we even have assessment methodologies as well. So these are a list of, and I'm not sure how, that's okay, that's readable. a large number of organisations who we have worked with or are currently working with. And the idea behind CAMI is, as I said, it's collaboration. So it's all about very disparate, different organisations getting together and working together to solve problems. So we will often find that we will get, for example, Boeing or Navistar trucks, very, very production-based commercial organisations, working with government organisations. And they're trying to solve a similar problem. It's different in sometimes in its execution, in that one's government-based, one's commercial. But when you combine the power of thought and the experiences that the different members of the working groups have, they come up with very considerable solutions that actually work quite well. We team where we can with technical knowledge partners and also universities and colleges. So what we like to do is if academic community is involved and interested, then we like to be able to utilise some of their skill sets as well. So I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about some of these concepts and innovations that I've chosen. I cherry-picked a few just because I find them interesting. So the first one is a concept called technology business management. So has anyone heard of this, TBM? Excellent. That's fantastic. So TBM is a framework. It's a common taxonomy. It's used by information technology departments and organizations. So if you've got an IT department, someone in there, probably the CIO, hopefully has heard of technology business management. It's basically a common taxonomy and framework that is used by an IT department to better describe A, what they do, and then the value that they're providing to their end customer. And it's, you can see the taxonomy here. It's for those that are done a lot of costing in their life, you can sort of see how it's morphed and how it's come about from something like activity-based costing. At the very bottom level here, you have this concept called cost pools. So what they're doing is they're grouping general ledger costs into like groups, pools of labour, internal labour, external labour, hardware, software, things like that. And it's a very prescribed pooling process. So when you read the documentation behind TBM, it's very specific that says these types of expenses will be going into specific cost pools. And there's not a lot of leeway, and that's for a reason. And then what TBM does is it takes those cost pools and it realigns them into a view that makes a bit more sense to the IT organisation. So rather than thinking about internal, external labour, they're repositioning those resources and thinking them in a term called IT towers. So I'm not particularly enamoured of the term IT towers, but it makes sense to IT people, so that's good. But it allows you to then pivot from looking at what an accountant would traditionally look at to something that makes more sense to the IT manager and essentially looking at things saying, well, this is how much we spend on compute. This is how much we spend on storage. This is how much we spend on our data centres or end-user support. And that's a useful view of the world. And the beauty of this taxonomy is it's very, very consistent and it's very prescribed. And so you get organisations across the world who are using this information and they're basically aligning everything in the same way, which allows you to do a lot of benchmarking. And so you can start to look at the cost of compute on a per server basis or the cost of storage on a per gigabyte basis. And if everyone is doing it in a consistent fashion, then you're much more comfortable being able to say, well, if his cost is $5 per gigabyte and my cost is $10 per gigabyte, I'm more comfortable in that benchmark at this point because there's a certain knowledge and a certain comfort that the underlying methodology is consistently being used by everyone. And that's nice if you're the IT department, but then in comes the business guy, the guy that IT is providing information for, and says, yeah, but why is it so expensive for compute? And I want to see what did I get for that dollar that I spent on servers and getting you guys to manage it for me? And that's when the next two layers, this service layer and the business unit and business capability layer, come into play. So what you're essentially doing with the service layer is you're now aligning those towers, those IT towers, with the applications and services that you're providing, either internally, so you're providing a data centre with computers in it and servers in it that allows you to host applications. And then you have external applications that you're providing for your end users. So you may have a SAP or some sort of ERP system that you're providing for the business areas, but you've also got applications that the end users are using for marketing and sales, etc. And so you end up being able to understand what's the cost of the individual services that we're delivering, and then you can tie them through to the business units that are providing that value for. So we're providing a marketing application for the marketing, or we're providing a customer relationship management tool for the marketing department. And then the challenge in all of this is being able to align in the business, not just the business unit that you're providing the information for and providing the service for, but tying in the value that it's producing for that organisation. And I'll talk a bit more about the value in a little bit. The key being that at the end of the day, the IT department is very easily able to explain to the end user, who is generally saying IT is costing us too much money, why it's costing so much money, and more importantly, change the conversation to allow them to have trade-offs about, well, okay, so you don't want to spend on this, or you don't want to give me the money to spend on this type of service that we're delivering. So which service would you like us to cut off? Because they can quantify it very well. It looks easy when you see it in that chart. It's not actually so easy. So it's like any sort of modelling that you do. Something like activity-based costing is very hard to do in execution. So this is a depiction of how you would essentially go through it. You take your general ledger costs. Your first step is to allocate those through or map them through to your cost pools. That's a fairly static process. In theory, once you've done it once, you shouldn't have to do it again, unless you start rewriting your chart of accounts. Then mapping the cost pools to the IT towers is probably the hardest thing to do. So I'm actually doing this work right now at Veterans Affairs in the US, in the Office of Information Technology there. And they have no information in any of their systems that relates to these IT towers. And so we're taking $4.5 billion of IT spend and we're trying to map it through to these 15, 20 towers with actually no data from the source system. So we're manually mapping all of this information, which is incredibly hard to do. But once they've done that, again, it remains fairly static and it's relatively easy to maintain it. And then what you do is you start taking those towers and mapping it to the services. And if you see this chart here, I figured that most people here would have heard of ABC and be familiar with the concept of resources, activities and cost objects. And so what I've done here is essentially showed the cost pools, the towers, and probably the first half of those services are what traditionally, if I'm thinking of ABC, I would think of as my resources. And then the activities in your traditional ABC model are really going to be the services component. It's the link between the left-hand side of that services and the right-hand side of that services. And then your cost objects or your outputs are really the end-user-facing applications, services that we provide, as well as the business capabilities that IT is supporting. Any questions on this so far? So the challenge with this, or one of the reasons I showed this, is because when I first started working in particularly cost management, what struck me was it's relatively easy to work out a cost of something. And what I would find is management accountants would be spending a lot of time, here's how much something costs. And then somewhere else in the business, a lot of people were measuring performance or some sort of output saying this is how well we do. And then someone would say, yeah, but what's the combination of those two things? And that was really, really hard to do. And it struck me when I first went to the States and I was doing some work for the Navy. And we were measuring readiness. So we were measuring cost. So we were basically saying, how much does it cost to train a ship to be fully trained from the day the crew walks onto the ship to the day it's ready to go to war? What does that cost? And there's a lot of resources involved, and it's hugely expensive. And it took us a long time to work it out. But then someone said to us, But how does that, if I want to increase the readiness of that ship, if I want to make sure that they can not just do anti-submarine warfare, but they can shoot a plane out of the sky as well, how do I know how much that's costing? So we said, well, that's what we know what it costs to do everything here. And we said, so all we need to know is how you measure readiness. And so we went across to the readiness people and said, how do you measure readiness? And they measured it in a completely different way. And so we said, well, we can't link the way you measure readiness to the way that we are capturing cost. So one of us has to change. And the readiness people said, we've been here longer, so we're not changing. So unfortunately, we had to change. So we devised this thing called a mission essential task list. And what it was actually already in process of being created by the readiness people, what they essentially do is they say, well, we have a mission, and we have a mission to detect enemy aircraft. And then beneath that mission, they have all sorts of tasks that they have to do. So we have to be able to run a radar. We have to be able to use a radar. We have to be able to know that the blip on the radar is a bad guy or a good guy. And then we need to work out what sort of bad guy it is, because that impacts what we shoot them out of the sky with or what we have to protect ourselves with. So there's all these little tasks. And they measure readiness in each one of those. And we said, well, if we can cost each one of those, now I can tie cost and readiness together very quickly and very easily. Which is what we ended up doing. It took us a complete redesign of the system that we'd created, but we have essentially got there. At the time, I thought it was out of the ordinary that we were capturing cost and performance in the same framework. And that's why I wanted to point this out, because it's a systematic approach by IT organizations to start to say, I need to measure my outputs, my value that I'm providing to my end customer, with the way I'm measuring my cost. And until I can do that, it's very difficult for them to have a really robust conversation with their end user, their internal customers, and be able to start having a seat at the table when they're talking through why they believe that they're important to the overall business and the value they provide to the business. So talking about value, this is a slide that I've had for a while, but I added to it, and in fact in the book there's the subsequent slides after this one. There's going to be a few new slides that you don't have, but we can get a new version of this to those that want it. So the way I think about value, or used to think about value, is very much pretty much what Julia was saying in your chart. You've got some sort of output performance, you've got some sort of cost, and the ratio of those two is essentially a measure of the value that you're providing for an organization. And the idea, if you sort of blend target costing with value measurement, is to see if you can come up with a target value idea, a target value metric. So what do I need to achieve in terms of level of performance and cost to make sure that whatever I'm delivering, whether it be a product, whether it be a service, meets my customers' expectations? I don't want to overproduce in value, I don't want to underproduce in value, and I don't want to spend too much to create that value, otherwise I'm not optimizing things correctly. So to understand that, you need to understand, first of all, what are the things that make up value, what does the customer even want, and what am I doing in spending to make up that value, and then what do I need in terms of resources to make sure I achieve that desired output. And that's why I think the common framework is a great way to achieve this, because it makes it very easy to combine the two concepts. So for the last 2 days, 3 days, I've been working with several people from Boeing Corporation, Hitachi Capital, Barclays Bank, the Ministry of Defence, and we were at the Grant Thornton office here in London. And we started we're trying to work out how do we create something that allows organisations to demonstrate the value of the support function. So if you're the finance department, how do you defend and define and demonstrate that what you're doing is valuable to the rest of the organisation? Inherently, people know I need a finance function, but often they'll say, we need to cut costs. Well, let's cut the cost of finance, of HR, not the pointy end of the stick who's doing all the work. Let's cut it from the background and the back end. And so we created what we are calling, and this is version not even 1.0, .1, 0.1, of what we're calling a principles-based framework. So on the left-hand side, These are some of the things that we've been thinking through belong in our framework. So what are the things that enable a back-end support function like finance department to demonstrate functional value within an organisation? And so there are a few key ones. The purpose of the organisation is documented and understood by everyone. It's interesting the number of times I think that if you went to the finance people and said, so what is your purpose? And you got 10 people out of the finance department, they would probably give slightly different answers as to what their overall purpose is and what they're doing, what their intent for the organisation is. The second principle is the functions within that department align to whatever the stakeholder or end customer is requiring. The third is that, and this is an interesting one, that you categorise your services via some sort of formal service catalogue. So it's not just a case of, yeah, we provide year-end closing for you, we provide some sort of budgeting formula for you. It's we have a service catalogue which is clearly defining the things that we do. And we believe that you should categorise each of the services that you provide in one of three ways. It's either some sort of compliance, you have to do it, it's regulatory, it's needed, it's what we consider essential, so it's lights on. If you don't do it, the business sort of shuts down, but it may not be necessarily value-added. And then there's value-adding activities that you do as well. And I'll talk a bit more about this concept of compliance, essential, and value-add in a second. The fourth principle is you have a functional culture internally that you're there to serve the stakeholder and you're doing that through a continuous improvement. You're always looking for ways to provide better delivery to the end customer, whoever that may be. And there's a few more here. Demonstrating value. So you've got to be able to have some way to demonstrate your value through quantitative or qualitative measures, and we believe that that's a very two-way conversation too. It's not just a metric that you internally measure, it's reaching out to the customer and saying, well, what is it you value and have we done it well? So things like customer surveys, things like that. And I think the other part that's quite important is that every team member has a role that they can link back to that service catalogue. So you don't have redundant people who are doing redundant tasks. And on the right-hand side here, we have tried, and it's very rudimentary at this point, to start to capture ways in which we think the value can be demonstrated. So satisfaction surveys, you could be measuring things like quality. Are we doing things right the first time? Are we doing it on time? How are we performing over time in terms of cost? We're looking at productivity improvements, perhaps. Employee engagement scores, which I think is an interesting one. So if you're in the finance area, measuring employment engagement scores is potentially a reflection on the value you're providing to the end customer. And then there are a couple of others, making sure that as a function you're viewed as a strategic business partner, and where applicable, if you're HR or finance, for example, you don't have breaches, regulatory legal breaches. So you're not getting, or you're minimising the number of those. So if you're the finance department, for example, the auditor didn't come through and find, seven findings that are critical to the organisation, you should be minimising those because, in our opinion, that's a compliance level type of service that you're providing. And then, of course, there's the external type of verification. So you can go and get ISO certified, whatever number you happen to have, or some other external validation that says, yes, the processes, systems, tools, etc., that we're using internally are externally validated as being something that's useful. So this looked a bit different, and Ashok will attest to this. He saw this, the first version of this, which we developed yesterday, which we called the Volcano of Value because at the very top it had this bubble. At the top, it looked like a pyramid with a huge amount of volcanic ash coming out of the top. So I removed that and made it a little less dramatic. So essentially, on the left-hand side, our hypothesis here, and we've yet to test all of this out, but our hypothesis here is on the left-hand side, you have a support function that is in its initial state. So it's starting to think about how do I increase the value to my end stakeholder, my end customer. And there are three types of services that it provides. It provides some sort of compliance, that's the bottom of the pyramid on the left, then what we call essential tasks, things that you have to do but aren't necessarily value-added but are found useful, and then the things at the top, which we are calling value-add, the things that the customer truly looks at and says, this is awesome, why weren't you doing this 10 years ago? And the theory is, if you think about it, the comply is the stuff of finance. You come in and you say, I don't care whether you want to do this or not, you've got to do it. Right? We have to do a year-end close. We have to do monthly closes. You may not like it, you may not provide value, but we're pushing that onto you, and you have to do it. That's the comply type of task. The value add is the ones that they call you and say, look, every time I go into this meeting, I can't understand my costs, and the guy's always badgering, why am I spending this much money? I don't know the accounts. Can one of you finance guys come with me, and we'll sit together through these meetings, and I'll have your support. That's the value add pull type function. Our hypothesis is that over time, things move from value add and they drop down lower. And I likened it to my cell phone, right? When Steve Jobs said, I'm going to combine an iPod with a phone, I remember the day I saw the news and I said to my wife, why in God's name would I want to have an iPod and a phone together? That's insane. My phone's great. I don't want to mess it up with music. And so to me at that time, I was thinking, that's nuts. But sure enough, it's now, you know, I bought one and said, well, that's value add. That's great. It's now become something that's essential. I don't see it as value add now. I need one of these phones because I check my email and everything else. So then they said, well, everyone now sees the phone as essential. We need to come up with something else that's value add. So I now have an Apple Watch. It proves two things. I'm a sucker for Apple marketing. But it also shows that what was once considered value add and something that's nice to have suddenly becomes essential. And so what we're suggesting is that in this ideal state, an organization is spending all its time doing comply initially, but the goal should be to invert the pyramid. So the goal should be spend less time complying and spend less energy and money complying and automate and make sure that the compliance function through things like AI and robotics, all sorts of other things, becomes something that you don't have to pay much attention on, so that you can spend all your attention and all of your effort on the value add at the top end. So rather than saying, yep, we're happy to just keep providing you an iPod, let's invent the iPhone, let's invent the iWatch, and keep providing value to the end customer, even though in many cases they may not think they need it. But eventually they will start to see it. Sometimes you'll get it wrong. Sometimes you'll get it right. You'll put out something that says, hey, here's a great idea. We think you guys want to buy it. And the response may be a resounding no, we don't care. But in other cases, we postulate that the value add, the more you add that value add at the top end and spend more time doing that, the more you move from being just seen as a costly cost center within an organization to more of a strategic partner with each of the different internal organizations that you're supporting. Any questions on that? Thoughts? Save them to the end. So, harking back to the we want one number, our ideal state, and I, to be honest with you, I don't think we'll ever get here, but our ideal state is to be able to come up with one magic number. This is the value that I provide as a finance organization to you, and the number is 7, and 7 may be good. It's a lofty goal, but the idea is to be able to start looking at value analysis and start doing the cost-value comparisons. And so what you see here is on the left-hand side you've got a chart where you can look at relative cost, you can look at relative importance, and essentially you can now start to look at the importance and the value that it's provided against the cost. So if you're something that's very costly, isn't giving you much importance, then perhaps you want to look at how do you reduce the cost of whatever that is. So is it one of your compliance functions that you think, well, if I can automate this, I can deliver it so much cheaper because it's not really valued by the end client, as opposed to something that's hugely valuable where, in fact, we're not spending a lot of money on it, so perhaps I can invest and make it even more valuable for the end customer. This sort of value analysis, it ties well into target costing. as a principle as well, where if you think about manufacturing and you've got different components that make up a truck, for example, if your customer is interested in moving sheets of plywood from point A to point B, the concept of selling them and building them a Ferrari is not a good idea. You want to build them some sort of truck with a flat bed at the back. And so what you can do is you can look at all of the components as they relate to the customer and what the customer values, and then you can make sure you essentially score the value of a flatbed truck. You score the value of having, a rubber matting on it so it doesn't scratch the paint. And if those things are valuable to the end customer because they're moving sheets of plywood, that's fantastic. You can then start to score that value, score the cost, and try and achieve a target that delivers the best value for the customer at the end of the day. Conversely, if your client or your customer is saying, I don't move sheet or plywood anywhere, I don't really care for that, what I want is a nice flashy car I can drive around in, the value statement changes, right? Mm-hmm. So now you're trying to build him a Ferrari or a McLaren or something like that, and you don't need a flatbed anymore. You need a nice V12 engine that sounds really noisy because everyone notices it. And so the value statements are changing, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to essentially align the value to what the customer wants and then measure the impact that value has and then work out where should you be focusing your development efforts, much like you would with target costing. Instead of trying to aim for a target price or a target cost, you're aiming for a target value. And that's where this sort of value analysis becomes quite useful. Actually, just one more point on that. The key to the doing the value analysis and the concepts that I've just been talking about, much like the technology business management, the TBM, is making sure that you have a common framework. If you don't have that common framework where you can combine value and cost together, then once again, it's very, very difficult to do. So another example of a common framework and tying things together, and this is some other work that we've been doing in CAMI, is looking at environmental sustainability and tackling that as an issue. And I contend that management accounting has a very strong role in environmental sustainability and helping organisations manage environmental sustainability. And it can do that without reinventing the wheel. And an example is something like activity-based costing, where you can adapt activity-based costing, and rather than flowing dollars through a model, you can flow a carbon footprint, you can flow a water footprint or a waste footprint through a model and be able to understand what's the impact of the way that you do business on your products, your services, the activities that you do from an environmental perspective as well as a cost perspective. And you can, once again, tie your environmental and cost measures together because you're using a common framework. And so we have done some work on linking activity-based costing and target costing to measuring and managing environmentally sustainable measures. So this is an example of a methodology that we have put together. It's very similar to ABC, where if you think about the second column here, your organizational resource information, they're your resources, you have activities, you have products and cost objects. The idea here is that your resources are consuming some sort of energy, in this case we're looking at carbon footprint. So if you imagine we've got an organization, let's say a mining company, they mine coal. So they have activities, they have facilities that are consuming electricity, they have people who are consuming electricity in office space, they have equipment that's burning oil, fuel, etc. All of those resources are consuming energy which has a footprint, a carbon footprint. There are activities that occur that will also inherently create a carbon footprint. So if you're digging coal out of the ground, for example, you release methane. Methane has an impact on the carbon dioxide levels, so essential greenhouse gas effect. So essentially what you're doing is the activities that you're doing plus the resources that are being consumed in the furtherance of those activities is essentially having an impact to your overall carbon footprint. And so by following your typical ABC principles, your traditional mapping of activities through to cost objects, you're able to not only work out what does it cost for us to produce product A, product B, or do activity A, activity B, but you're also able to measure the footprint, the carbon footprint, or if you're measuring water, the water footprint of those same activities. And so you can start to, if I go back to that last slide, you go back to the last slide, you're able to start saying, well, if I've got something that's got a very high carbon footprint, but it's got very low value to the organisation, or it's not costing us a whole lot, I can work out how do I reduce that footprint? Is there mechanisms, are there things that I can do in terms of changing the resources I use, changing the activities I do to reduce that footprint? Because I don't want a high carbon footprint and low value. Conversely, I may have something that's got a very low footprint but a high value, and that's great. Well, I can leave that. I don't necessarily need to do anything to that, either activity or those resources, because I'm getting a lot of value out of that resource and how it's contributing to the organisation and that product, but it's not costing me a lot in terms of my carbon footprint. The key here, once again, the common theme with all three of these things that I've presented is having a common framework so that you can tie in all of the things that are of interest to you, tie in that cost, tie in the performance, tie in the value calculation, and you can start to combine them all. Because value is very nice to understand, and it's great to understand. I think cost is great to understand, but you can't manage on one or other alone. You have to manage with both, and it's much easier, in my opinion, to manage on both when you can define them in the same way somehow. And so with that, I'm going to stop and see if anyone has any questions or comments, good or bad.
I'll put a question to Anthony, if I may, while you're thinking, all right, because there's a lot to take in there, a lot of very clever slides. Trying to put together what we were talking about earlier, Rick and David talking about new technologies, a challenge in business now is that there aren't many resources available to invest in new technologies. So what tends to happen is they invest in the front end, and they don't invest well in the back end. So you see a lot of management accountants are still doing workarounds with legacy systems, and the accountants can't make a business case for investing in these systems.
Yep.
So what's your advice to them? If they say, we want to invest in some AI technology for the finance functions or robotic process automation or blockchain, if anybody will listen to them, how do they make the case?
That's a really good question. So I would say it depends on who you are, right? So, in fact, the IT organization will argue that you need something like TBM. And the reason for that is it allows them to identify efficiencies they can make in what they call run the business. So this is the cost to run the business. It's all of the maintenance every day. And then they have this term in the IT world called change the business. So that's the reinvesting in new technology. So I don't want to have this old ERP system. I want a brand new ERP system, but I'm too busy running this thing to afford to do that thing. So if I have an understanding of what it's costing me and ways that I can improve the efficiency of this, whether it's through buying a new ERP system that's software as a service and I don't have to worry about half the servers, etc., I can save money there, then I can shift it to over here to change the business. So I think there's an element of being able to say, being able to quantify not just what it's costing you, although that's important because that gives you the ability to show the efficiencies. I can save money here and I'm doing here. Net difference is going to be zero to you at the end of the day for this change. But I think you also need to be able to quantify the impact that change is going to have on the business. And that's why I always harp on the fact that you need to be able to define those two in the same way. Because if you don't, it's really, really difficult for an outsider who isn't involved in calculating all of this, so that stakeholder, it's really difficult for them to understand and draw the line between, you said $10 and this is the value, but if you're not talking the exact same framework for those two things, then it's very hard to equate the two. And I think it adds to the argument if you can.
No, I love the logic that we need a common framework for costs and for revenues so we can bring these together, and obviously we need some kind of common framework so we can talk to our colleagues in IT. But suppose they aren't there. Suppose we've outsourced IT, and there isn't IT strategic thinking in the business, because this is true of many businesses now. You know, what's the role of the accountant? Can the accountant be the horizon scanner and make
yes,
the case?
I think the accountant can. Yeah, I see this more times than not. Everyone turns to the management accountant and says, "I need the answer of what it costs." Right? Everyone does. And more the management accountant to be able to answer those questions is having to reach out to every other part of the business. It's no longer good enough just to say it costs $10. I now need to say, yeah, but that was associated with this many bed nights or this many, you know, this number of widgets that we produced. And so the accountant to me has become the hub for a lot of intel and a lot of data and intelligence that's required to answer the fundamental questions, because it's no longer good enough just to answer a cost. So I think the management accountant's role of the future is to be able to essentially become the focal point, not just for your traditional management accounting, give me a dollar amount, but all of the analytics associated with the peripheral questions that get asked. Because when someone says it costs me a lot of money, the next question is why? Well, now I've got to delve into all sorts of other information that isn't the traditional realm of the management accountant. And so I think becoming the hub and becoming the quasi-owner of that, sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not, I think is a role that a lot of management accountants have yet to fill.
This is what Paolo Cotrone would teach us. We ought to be asking the questions.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Question here from Professor Ben.
I was very pleased to see that Chemai is still going strong. I had an involvement with them in the late 1990s and early 2000s, slated to give a presentation in Jackson Hole that I never gave because it was September 11, 2001.
That's right. A lot of people from Chemai got stuck in Jackson Hole when they put all the
I was one of them. Now, that's not a reason for my question. I think what I hear you say is value. But you still have this cost-centered sort of methodology. Mm-hmm. It's very rigorous. It's very analytical. Cost pools, activities, target. This has been happening for a quarter of a century. It's still going strong. The list of firms that you showed is impressive. They're still benefiting from it. But then when I think, and I checked your list, Amazon is not on that list. Mm-hmm. And I have a hypothesis, and it could be completely wrong, or an impression, that Amazon does not have time for this. They are busy conquering the world and not worry about costs. I don't know if it's true. It's the impression that I have. Mm-hmm. So here's the nut or the conceptual underpinning of my question. Clearly, many organizations benefit from this. Clearly, there are other ones that completely ignore this. What is the difference between the two?
So I have no empirical evidence for this whatsoever. It's purely my opinion. I would say that in time, Amazon will need this.
Yeah.
They don't need it today because they're riding a wave that they don't need to bother with this. They're in the what I call, admittedly, they only just made a profit, but they had a really rich guy who was backing them. They are in what I call the fat and happy stage. So they don't have to think about this.
Yeah.
If you think about the pharmaceutical business of 20 years ago, they were fat and happy. They didn't have to worry about making sure every penny was counted for, making sure that they could demonstrate value of what they were producing. I think that world has changed for certainly many businesses, like the pharmaceutical industry, and I would say that the Amazons, the Apples of this world, that day is coming for them at some point. It's just not here yet.
Okay. Yeah.
But I would also say that the theory tells me that if you manage value appropriately, you could do it without cost. It's much like lean. Logic, right? If I lean a process and I apply Six Sigma principles, cost will go down. I like to trust but verify. So what I want to be able to do is say, yes, I can demonstrate that I've improved value, but I want to verify that that's actually making numbers head in the right direction for us as well.
Yeah, thank you. Yep.
Very good.
Thank you. Any others?
Any more? Simon again. Right.
Oh, maybe, yes. I could see your basic structure of allocation of costs, but you're going from one cost center, all intents and purposes, to another, albeit in a IT framework. The main issue there is to try to determine cost drivers. How you go about identifying individual cost drivers to allocate those costs to the specific cost center areas and across the board, across the piece of IT technology. Thank you.
Yeah. So if I heard that correctly, is how do you identify the cost drivers? That's a really good question. I use an iterative approach. I use this concept of good, better, best, because generally when I start doing this sort of stuff, no data exists whatsoever. And so you're going out there and saying, I'll take whatever I can get. Sometimes I have to actually go and ask people what that number is because they don't actually have it written down or have it in a database. But the aim is to always improve that. So as an example, if I'm looking at something in the IT organization about end-user services and how much did my help desk provide, what sort of services did my help desk provide, ideally what I want to know is I want to know how many help desk calls you took, what the call was about. Was it about your desktop? Was it about an application? Which application was it about? And who did you work for? So I know which business area that we were supporting at the time. Many have that because they have a good system to collect that information. But if they don't have that information, then what I'll do is I'll take a step back and say, okay, what do you have? And they'll say, I just have the number of help desk calls. Okay, I'll take that. But or even one step backwards, I'll take just the number of users that I've got from some sort of Active Directory scan that says I've got 10,000 users in this part of the organization and 20,000 in that part of the organization. It's not ideal, but it allows me to get a better view of the world than I have before I started. So I don't think there is any magic answer to how you detect those cost drivers and the best ones to use, other than sort of a trial and error and an iterative maturity, increase your maturity over time approach. Does that help answer the question?
Very good. Right, well, it just remains for me now to say thank you very much to Anthony Pember of Grant Thornton and Kenard. Thank you very much.